Episode 322, Chapter 22. Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion. Episode 322, It's a Mitzvah. This episode brought to you by Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories for heart and home. And Knit Circus, the e-newsletter delivered to your mailbox, bringing you three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more at www.knitcircus.com. And Pennywise Consulting, technology solutions for your small business. And links to all of our sponsors can be found in the sidebar of the show notes at craftlit.com. Please visit them, as their support for the show is one of the things that keeps it free for you. Well, hello, I am back. Thank you so much for understanding my need to take the week off. I only wound up in the hospital twice, so it can't be all that bad, right? I did. I wound up in the emergency room. Well, I wound up at urgent care the Friday before the bar mitzvah because I had a horrible stress hives reaction. They had to give me a shot, and then they had to give me prednisone. Loads of fun. And then I asked them at the urgent care place. I said, I have an appointment next Tuesday with a new doctor, and I need to get the flu shot and the pneumonia shot. Is it going to be okay? And they said, sure. In fact, you're going to be taking prednisone, so any reaction you might have will be mitigated by that. So don't worry about a thing. It'll be sore, because the flu shot this year is evidently one that is making lots of people sore in their arm. But it shouldn't be a problem. So I go to the doctor on Tuesday and I say, now I know I'm supposed to get my flu shot today and my pneumonia shot today. And is there going to be a problem with me getting both shots at the same time? No. I haven't heard of anybody having any reactions. Should be just fine. Uh-huh. We still don't know exactly what happened. But by 8 o'clock at night, I couldn't move my left arm at all. And you know how even during childbirth, up until those last few minutes, you can always get yourself into a position where there's like some relief, like a neutral position where you can find some some comfort, some way that you can pass out at least for a little while before the pain kicks in again. I couldn't. In fact, the pain was so bad, it made me throw up. That's how bad the pain was. So the next morning, after crowdsourcing my situation at 3 a.m. on Facebook, I went to the emergency room and they said, here, have some Vicodin. And I said, it won't work. And they said, take it anyway. And it didn't work. It doesn't work on me at all. So time worked, but at least there wasn't any, you know, nerve damage or anything. But I'll tell you, it's been a week and a half now and I am still sore. I still have a hard time. Those muscles got walloped by whatever was in that shot. But gosh darn it, I am not going to get the flu this year, and I am not going to get pneumonia again, because I would rather have a shot and lose the mobility of my left arm for a couple of days than have to go through pneumonia again. Ever. So yes, it was an event. We had a great time. Bar mitzvah went very, very well. And I was thinking, you know, those of you who are not Jewish have never probably heard the Torah, which is the Christian Old Testament. It's the first five books of Moses. You've probably never heard it chanted before. So I thought I'd give you a little treat and let you hear just a little bit of what my son sounded like when he was up there with that giant Torah scroll written in very small Hebrew calligraphy with no vowels or punctuation of any kind. This is what it sounds like.
Amen. Ve'ele toldot Yitzchak ben Avraham. Avraham holid et Yitzchak. Vayehi Yitzchak ben Arbaim shana bekachto et Rivka. Bat Betuel harami mi pada aram achot lavan harami lo leisha Vayetzar Yitzchak l'Adonai l'Nochach Ishto Ki Akarahiv Vayater Lo Adonai V'Tachar Rivka Ishto.
And that's what it sounded like. I did not sit there with my recording equipment, of course. We got a DVD, and I was able to record off of the DVD. But that gives you a little flavor. He had to do three of these long passages, these aliyot, for the Torah portion for that day. And then he had to write and give a speech, which I thought he did a very nice job at. And, of course, all of the family is there because it's a big, big, huge honkin' deal. So when I said at the beginning that... it's a mitzvah. A mitzvah, literally in Hebrew, is a commandment. But in kind of colloquial usage, it becomes a word that you use when you say it's a mitzvah. It's something you're supposed to do. You're supposed to go sit shiva with people who have lost someone close to them. That is a mitzvah. It's a good thing to do. It's something you're supposed to do, sure. But it's one of those things that's good to do for you, but also for the other person. Going and being a witness of somebody becoming a bar or bat mitzvah is a mitzvah. You're supposed to do it, sure, but it's also a really great thing to do. Visiting the sick, things like that. So you have now, by extension, participated in my mitzvah. You've heard my son chant Torah, and it's pretty cool. It was really neat, and he looked so good. He was such a put him on him. He's so cute. So... that only put me in the hospital twice. I'm impressed. But back to the work at hand. Listener Jill graciously donated some fabulous books for use as giveaways. We had the giveaway for Ne'er-Do-Well Knits, and we had the giveaway for the creative, the cute and simple baby crochet book. And both of those went out to the winners. And if you want to check out who won, you can look on the show notes. Their names will be listed on the little raffle copter thingies. There is a new giveaway for the month of November, and Jill's book that she has given to you is a hardback book. It still has its dust jacket. It's in really nice shape. It's Inspired Fair Isle Knits, 20 Creative Designs Inspired by the Elements by Fiona Ellis. The book was originally written in 2007, and I think it's really... it has not dated itself at all. There are scarves, there are sweaters, obviously there are sweaters. There's a bag pattern towards the end. There's some really nice stuff. And I particularly like this because she used Aristotle and Aristotle's elements as her basis for the inspiration of this book. It's a very Defargian kind of way to do things. And if you've read Grounded, of course, you'll know that the fire, air, earth, and water thing is close to my heart. So this is the book that we will raffle off this month. The giveaway link is working again, so you can follow the link in the show notes to our giveaway page for check episode 322's show notes. And I went to see Ender's Game the day after the bar mitzvah. My mom and husband and the kids, we all went and saw it. Everybody who read the book was allowed to go. And it was pretty good. Not as good as the book, you know, but that's because the book is awesome. And I needed to knit. I had been going an entire week without knitting because of my arm, and I needed to knit something very simple. So I am making a very simple plain vanilla shawl pattern, which I will be putting out with a plain vanilla sock pattern. But the sock will have some very special little extras to it. So if you're a brand new sock knitter, I would say do a really true plain vanilla sock first, and then you can move over to the plain vanilla with cherries on top that I'll be putting out soon. The other things that are going out are the grounded socks. We've now released our first three. We have Rosie's Fire Starters, we have Izzy's Bouncin' Blues, and we have Jen's Subtle Magics. And the next one depends on which socks get to me first. It's either going to be Jasmine's Ethereal Socks or Justin's Stubborn Socks. And one of those two will be the next released in that series. We're going to get them all out to you before the Christmas holidays start, so you'll be able to knit them up. And in fact, one of our test and sample knitters wrote and said that she's actually knit four of the socks that are going to be in the book of eight. And she flies through the sock knitting thing. And she wears her Izzy socks all the time, she said. So that made me happy. And thank you again. Grounded continues to do well. It's selling nicely on Amazon. Reviews are coming in. Got my first really negative review on Goodreads. But, you know, even Neil Gaiman gets them. So I figure if that's the worst I get, I'm doing great. And what else? Oh, it's the Ravelry read on Goodreads for the month of November. So if you're on Goodreads and didn't know there was a Ravelry group, now you do. Number one, anyone can join. And the official Let's All Read Something Together book for the month of November is my novel Grounded. So I'm very excited about that. It's NaNoWriMo time here in my home. And I am working hard and fast on the sequel to Grounded. So within the year, the sequel should be out, is my hope. It does take a while to write a book, I have found. Even though you can get, you know, 50,000 words or even 92,000 words, which is what I originally did when I first wrote Grounded as a NaNoWriMo novel, the editing and refining and perfecting takes quite a long time. And some of you have even noticed, even with a professional editor who looked at it more than once, and me and my husband, there were still a couple of typos that got through in the book. It's a 460 some odd page book, so I'm not terribly surprised, but it's a lot of work getting that thing right. So we've corrected those in the electronic versions of the book and are in the process of correcting the printed copy of the book as well. So, all right, time to get to the Age of Innocence. And I was really rather relieved that this chapter was for this week because it's a brief chapter. It's, I would say, a minor chapter in the grand scheme of things, but it gives us some really important background knowledge to the Welland family, who we've seen, but we haven't really seen a whole lot of in their day-to-day interactions. We'll get a little more information on the Welland family. A very interesting reaction from May towards Newland. And then, of course, more of what's going on inside Newland's head, or not consciously going on inside Newland's head, as he deals with the early stages of married life. Wharton's terminology in this chapter is not particularly difficult. There aren't any words that I feel are going to be archaic for you or anything like that. But there are some turns of phrase that she uses that I think are painful, as so many things are in this book, but also very telling. There was the really wonderful comment that I read to you from a listener in the last episode, and Gemma talked today, or rather left a comment on the Craftlit show notes that I got this morning, that talked about how Newland really looks like, or behaves like, someone who is going through a midlife crisis. And I think that's really true. It's definitely the feeling that I get from watching Newland kind of fnump around, having a hard time coming to terms with being Newland. But I also think that the tragedy here, the thing that's so shocking, is that he's in his 20s. And no one should be going through what he's going through in their 20s. That's just wrong. But there's also the added thing of him kind of looking wistfully in that grass is always greener kind of way at Ned Winsett or at the secretary, and somehow thinking that there is a nobility, a romance to the lives that they lead, instead of, you know, noticing that they live in cold water flats and don't have nice clothes and don't have servants and things like that. And Newland just doesn't ever seem to process that properly. And in fact, the couple of times we've seen him have conversations with Ned Winsett, we're left at the end of those conversations with that realization that Newland really doesn't understand Winsett. And it's interesting because I've just been having a conversation with Julie at Forgotten Classics again about Frankenstein. And that comment that I made 100,000 years ago, that the groups that are in the minority always understand the groups in the majority better than the other way around. The majority doesn't need to understand the groups below them, beneath them, beside them even. They are the majority. They do what they want because they are the majority. And in Newland's world, that society is the majority. People know a lot more about how the rich live than the rich do about how the poor survive or don't. And that is a constant theme here in the United States. I don't know if that kind of issue happens as much overseas. I suppose it does. Anytime there's immigration, right? You're going to have the immigrant group coming in is going to understand more about the dominant, already assimilated group than the assimilated group will understand about the newcomers, the people who are new to the country. So I suppose you'd have those same kinds of questions. And I suppose in a society that has a fairly structured class stratification, you would see that same kind of thing happening. And I think it's definitely happening here. Newland really doesn't get what Winsett's life is like, or the secretary's life is like. And in lots of ways, he really doesn't get what Ellen's life is like either. So today is really one of those setup chapters. We're moving the chess pieces into position for what happens in next week's chapter. But there are some, as I said, luscious pieces of writing. And I think Brenda does a beautiful job of communicating this kind of patrician shock and humorous horror at the opening of the chapter. It's wonderful to listen to. And then Wharton talks about how Mrs. Welland, May's mother, looks at the way one should spend one's days. And boy, did this ring bells in my memory too. And if you are one of those people with busy hands, you know, who were raised in the idle hands are the devil's playground kind of thing, and you were raised to do things like knit and crochet and cross stitch and quilt and sew and all of these things, her comments, I had to laugh because there's kind of a snarkiness to them. But I also get it because I have this horrible, horrible feeling that I am Mrs. Welland. I'm not really happy about that, but I can't help but feel like on some level, yeah, well, me too. And I would look at Newland just as askance as Mrs. Welland does. So listen to that. It's in the beginning of the chapter and see where you fall on that continuum because you might get a good giggle out of that. All right, enough. I am launching you into Chapter 22 of The Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton.
Chapter 22. A Party for the Blenkers. The Blenkers. Mr. Welland laid down his knife and fork and looked anxiously and incredulously across the luncheon table at his wife, who, adjusting her gold eyeglasses, read aloud in the tone of high comedy, "Professor and Mrs. Emerson Sillerton request the pleasure of Mr. and Mrs. Welland's company at the meeting of the Wednesday Afternoon Club on 25 August at 3 o'clock punctually, to meet Mrs. and the Mrs. Blenker. Red Gables, Catherine Street, RSVP." "Good gracious," Mr. Welland gasped, as if a second reading had been necessary to bring the monstrous absurdity of the thing home to him. "Poor Amy Sillerton, you can never tell what her husband will do next," Mrs. Welland sighed. "I suppose he's just discovered the Blenkers." Professor Emerson Sillerton was a thorn in the side of Newport society, and a thorn that could not be plucked out, for it grew on a venerable and venerated family tree. He was, as people said, a man who had every advantage. His father was Sillerton Jackson's uncle, his mother a Pennilow of Boston. On each side there was wealth and position and mutual suitability. Nothing on earth obliged Emerson Sillerton to be an archaeologist, or indeed a professor of any sort, or to live in Newport in winter, or do any of the other revolutionary things that he did. But at least, if he was going to break with tradition and flout society in the face, he need not have married poor Amy Dagonet, who had a right to expect something different, and money enough to keep her own carriage. No one in the Mingott set could understand why Amy Sillerton had submitted so tamely to the eccentricities of a husband who filled the house with long-haired men and short-haired women, and when he traveled, took her to explore tombs in Yucatan instead of going to Paris or Italy. But there they were, set in their ways, and apparently unaware that they were different from other people. And when they gave one of their dreary annual garden parties, every family on the cliffs, because of the Sillerton-Pennilow-Dagonet connection, had to draw lots and sent an unwilling representative. "It's a wonder," Mrs. Welland remarked, "that they didn't choose the Cup race day. Do you remember 2 years ago their giving a party for a black man on the day of Julia Mingott's The Dansant? Luckily, this time there's nothing else going on that I know of, for of course some of us will have to go." Mr. Welland sighed nervously. "Some of us, my dear, more than one? 3 o'clock is such a very awkward hour. I have to be here at 3:30 to take my drops. It really is no use trying to follow Bencombe's new treatment if I don't do it systematically. And if I join you later, of course, I shall miss my drive." At the thought, he laid down his knife and fork again, and a flush of anxiety rose to his finely wrinkled cheek. "Oh, there's no reason why you should go at all, my dear," his wife answered, with a cheerfulness that had become automatic. "I have some cards to leave at the other end of Bellevue Avenue, and I'll drop in about 3:30 and stay long enough to make poor Amy feel that she hasn't been slighted." She glanced hesitatingly at her daughter. "And if Newland's afternoon is provided for, perhaps May can drive you out with the ponies and try their new russet harness." It was a principle in the Welland family that people's days and hours should be what Mrs. Welland called provided for. The melancholy possibility of having to kill time, especially for those who did not care for whist or solitaire, was a vision that haunted her, as the specter of the unemployed haunts the philanthropist. Another of her principles was that parents should never, at least visibly, interfere with the plans of their married children, and the difficulty of adjusting this respect for May's independence with the exigency of Mrs. Welland's claims could be overcome only by the exercise of an ingenuity which left not a second of Mrs. Welland's own time unprovided for. "Of course I'll drive with Papa. I'm sure Newland will find something to do," May said in a tone that gently reminded her husband of his lack of response. It was a cause of constant distress to Mrs. Welland that her son-in-law showed so little foresight in planning his days. Often, already during the fortnight that he had passed under her roof, when she inquired how he meant to spend his afternoon, he had answered paradoxically, "Oh, I think for a change I'll just save it instead of spending it." And once, when she and May had had to go on a long-postponed round of afternoon calls, he had confessed to having lain all the afternoon under a rock on the beach below the house. "Newland never seems to look ahead," Mrs. Welland once ventured to complain to her daughter, and May answered serenely, "No, but you see it doesn't matter, because when there's nothing particular to do, he reads a book." "Oh, yes, like his father," Mrs. Welland agreed, as if allowing for an inherited oddity. And after that, the question of Newland's unemployment was tacitly dropped. Nevertheless, as the day for the Sillerton reception approached, May began to show a natural solicitude for his welfare, and to suggest a tennis match at the Chiverses, or a sail on Julius Beaufort's cutter, as a means of atoning for her temporary desertion. "I shall be back by 6, you know, dear. Papa never drives later than that." And she was not reassured till Archer said that he thought of hiring a runabout and driving up the island to a stud farm to look at a second horse for her broom. They had been looking for this horse for some time, and the suggestion was so acceptable that May glanced at her mother as if to say, "You see, he knows how to plan out his time as well as any of us." The idea of the stud farm and the broom horse had germinated in Archer's mind on the very day when the Emerson Sillerton invitation had first been mentioned. But he had kept it to himself, as if there were something clandestine in the plan, and discovery might prevent its execution. He had, however, taken the precaution to engage in advance a runabout with a pair of old livery stable trotters that could still do their 18 miles on level roads, and at 2 o'clock, hastily deserting the luncheon table, he sprang into the light carriage and drove off. The day was perfect. A breeze from the north drove little puffs of white cloud across an ultramarine sky, with a bright sea running under it. Bellevue Avenue was empty at that hour, and after dropping the stable lad at the corner of Mill Street, Archer turned down the old beach road and drove across Eastman's Beach. He had the feeling of unexplained excitement with which, on half-holidays at school, he used to start off into the unknown. Taking his pair at an easy gait, he counted on reaching the stud farm, which was not far beyond Paradise Rocks, before 3 o'clock, so that, after looking over the horse and trying him if he seemed promising, he would still have 4 golden hours to dispose of. As soon as he heard of the Sillerton's party, he had said to himself that the Marchioness Manson would certainly come to Newport with the Blenkers, and that Madame Olenska might again take the opportunity of spending the day with her grandmother. At any rate, the Blenker habitation would probably be deserted, and he would be able, without indiscretion, to satisfy a vague curiosity concerning it. He was not sure that he wanted to see the Countess Olenska again. But ever since he had looked at her from the path above the bay, he had wanted, irrationally and indescribably, to see the place she was living in, and to follow the movements of her imagined figure as he had watched the real one in the summer house. The longing was with him day and night, an incessant, undefinable craving, like the sudden whim of a sick man for food and drink once tasted and long since forgotten. He could not see beyond the craving, or picture what it might lead to, for he was not conscious of any wish to speak to Madame Olenska or to hear her voice. He simply felt that if he could carry away the vision of the spot of earth she walked on, and the way the sky and sea enclosed it, the rest of the world might seem less empty. When he reached the stud farm, a glance showed him that the horse was not what he wanted. Nevertheless, he took a turn behind it in order to prove to himself that he was not in a hurry. But at 3 o'clock, he shook out the reins over the trotters and turned into the byroads leading to Portsmouth. The wind had dropped, and a faint haze on the horizon showed that a fog was waiting to steal up the Saconnet on the turn of the tide. But all about him, fields and woods were steeped in golden light. He drove past gray shingled farmhouses in orchards, past hayfields and groves of oak, past villages with white steeples rising sharply into the fading sky. And at last, after stopping to ask the way of some men at work in a field, he turned down a lane between high banks of goldenrod and brambles. At the end of the lane was the blue glimmer of the river. To the left, standing in front of a clump of oaks and maples, he saw a long, tumble-down house with white paint peeling from its clapboards. On the roadside facing the gateway stood one of the open sheds in which the New Englander shelters his farming implements and visitors hitch their teams. Archer, jumping down, led his pair into the shed, and after tying them to a post, turned towards the house. The patch of lawn before it had relapsed into a hayfield, but to the left an overgrown box garden full of dahlias and rusty rose bushes encircled a ghostly summer house of trellis work that had once been white, surmounted by a wooden cupid who had lost his bow and arrow, but continued to take ineffectual aim. Archer leaned for a while against the gate. No one was in sight, and not a sound came from the open windows of the house. A grizzled Newfoundland dozing before the door seemed as ineffectual a guardian as the arrowless Cupid. It was strange to think that this place of silence and decay was the home of the turbulent Blinkers, yet Archer was sure that he was not mistaken. For a long time he stood there, content to take in the scene and gradually falling under its drowsy spell. But at length he roused himself to the sense of the passing time. Should he look his fill and then drive away? He stood irresolute, wishing suddenly to see the inside of the house so that he might picture the room that Madame Olenska sat in. There was nothing to prevent his walking up to the door and ringing the bell. If, as he supposed, she was away with the rest of the party, he could easily give his name and ask permission to go into the sitting room to write a message. But instead, he crossed the lawn and turned towards the box garden. As he entered it, he caught sight of something bright-colored in the summer house and presently made it out to be a pink parasol. The parasol drew him like a magnet. He was sure it was hers. He went into the summer house and, sitting down on the rickety seat, picked up the silken thing and looked at its carved handle, which was made of some rare wood that gave out an aromatic scent. Archer lifted the handle to his lips. He heard a rustle of skirts against the box and sat motionless, leaning on the parasol handle with clasped hands and letting the rustle come nearer without lifting his eyes. He had always known that this must happen. "Oh, Mr. Archer!" exclaimed a loud young voice, and looking up he saw before him the youngest and largest of the Blenker girls, blonde and blousy, in bedraggled muslin. A red blotch on one of her cheeks seemed to show that it had recently been pressed against a pillow, and her half-awakened eyes stared at him hospitably but confusedly. "Gracious, where did you drop from? I must have been sound asleep in the hammock. Everybody else has gone to Newport. Did you ring?" she incoherently inquired. Archer's confusion was greater than hers. I was just going to. I had to come up to the island to see about a horse, and I drove over on the chance of finding Mrs. Blenker and your visitors, but the house seemed empty, so I sat down to wait." Miss Blenker, shaking off the fumes of sleep, looked at him with increasing interest. "The house is empty. Mother's not here, or the Marchioness, or anybody but me." Her glance became faintly reproachful. "Didn't you know that Professor and Mrs. Sillerton are giving a garden party for Mother and all of us this afternoon? It was too unlucky I couldn't go, but I've had a sore throat and Mother was afraid of the drive home this evening. Did you ever know anything so disappointing? Of course," she added gaily, "I shouldn't have minded half as much if I'd known you were coming." Symptoms of a lumbering coquetry became visible in her, and Archer found the strength to break in. "But Madame Olenska, has she gone to Newport, too?" Miss Blenker looked at him with surprise. "Madame Olenska? Didn't you know she'd been called away?" "Called away? Oh, my best parasol! I lent it to that goose of a Katie because it matched her ribbons, and the careless thing must have dropped it here. We Blenkers are all like that, real bohemians." Recovering the sunshade with a powerful hand, she unfurled it and suspended its rosy dome above her head. "Yes, Ellen was called away yesterday. She lets us call her Ellen, you know. A telegram came from Boston. She said she might be gone for 2 days. I do love the way she does her hair, don't you?" Miss Blenker rambled on. Archer continued to stare through her as though she had been transparent. All he saw was the trumpery parasol that arched its pinkness above her giggling head. After a moment he ventured, "You don't happen to know why Madame Olenska went to Boston. I hope it was not on account of bad news." Miss Blenker took this with a cheerful incredulity. "Oh, I don't believe so. She didn't tell us what was in the telegram. I think she didn't want the Marchioness to know. She's so romantic-looking, isn't she? Doesn't she remind you of Mrs. Scott Siddons when she reads Lady Geraldine's Courtship? Did you never hear her?" Archer was dealing hurriedly with crowding thoughts. His whole future seemed suddenly to be unrolled before him, and passing down its endless emptiness, he saw the dwindling figure of a man to whom nothing was ever to happen. He glanced about him at the unpruned garden, the tumble-down house, and the oak grove under which the dusk was gathering. It had seemed so exactly the place in which he ought to have found Madame Olenska, and she was far away, and even the pink sunshade was not hers. He frowned and hesitated. "You don't know, I suppose. I shall be in Boston tomorrow. If I could just manage to see—" He felt that Miss Blinker was losing interest in him, though her smile persisted. "Oh, of course. How lovely of you. She's staying at the Parker House. It must be horrible there in this weather." After that, Archer was but intermittently aware of the remarks they exchanged. He could only remember stoutly resisting her entreaty that he should await the returning family and have a high tea with them before he drove home. At length, with his hostess still at his side, he passed out of range of the wooden Cupid, unfastened his horses, and drove off. At the turn of the lane, he saw Miss Blinker standing at the gate and waving the pink parasol. End of chapter 22.
So that moment when he thought it was Ellen, the way she wrote that, he always knew it would be like this. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is awesome, because Edith Wharton showed up all of the Victorian romances at that moment. It's just like in a Danielle Steele. That's exactly what you would expect to happen. He always knew they would meet like this. He turned slowly, looked into her eyes. You know, it's that kind of thing. But no, not in Wharton, not in this book, not right now. And that's part of, I think that's part of the brutality of this book in some ways, is that on the one hand, it feels like a very mannered kind of anti-romance. You know, there's the romantic stuff, but it's not working out, and there you go. But on the other hand, it's a book that's working against your expectations. It's working against type. And we're constantly reminded that life is not a Danielle Steele novel. And Edith Wharton's life was not a Danielle Steele novel. So it's not a huge surprise that she wrote about this and about these missed opportunities and lost loves and things like that. It's just that she does it so beautifully. I've been struck over and over again, especially in the hustle and bustle of the last couple of weeks, trying to get the bar mitzvah together and have family in town and all of this. I've been struck over and over again at how quiet this book is, how gently the words are laid out for us in the narrative, but how brutal the constant frustration and sense of loss is for Newland, and we can only assume for Ellen. And then there's also May. How does May not know? Or does she know? Does she care? Is her only job to just show up and have kids? We haven't gotten to that part yet. We don't know really what's going on with May quite yet. We will eventually find out where she's at in all of this. But for now, it really is Newland's story with a side dish of Ellen. And quiet, so quiet. That subtle silence of despair. It is, it's hard. It's good. It's good. And it also gives us something to fight against, right? Because now, after reading this, if we look at our own lives, if we're honest with ourselves and look at our own lives, can we see ourselves pulling a Newland? Is that okay? Should we be pushing ourselves? Should we be doing more, different, better, other? I think that's, you know, that's the interesting thing. Like my son's bar mitzvah speech this week. His Torah portion was the Jacob and Esau story, the part about the birthright. And his question was all about, and this was 100% my kid. He did not get counseled on this at all. It was, if Jacob and Esau had learned to get along, if their father hadn't pushed them to see it as an all or nothing zero sum game, one of you's getting the birthright and one of you won't. And if they had found a way to, or if they had found a way to get along, regardless of what their father did, how different that story would be and how much happier they both would have been. And it always strikes me that when you're reading, especially the Old Testament stories, so many of them are put there, it seems, as a, hey, don't try this at home, kids. You know, this is not how to behave. This is not the way Cain and Abel, this is not how to behave. And it gives us that marvelous opportunity to watch someone else make the mistakes. I've always thought that that's one of the greatest things about literature. You can watch someone else make the mistakes and learn from it if you're lucky and do better yourself and have a better life because of it. Or, you know, not. I've been wrestling a lot lately with trying to justify or validate the podcast, the amount of time that I spend on the podcasts. And great literature, classic literature, does it matter? If nobody ever read any of these books ever again, if nobody ever read Flatland or Jane Eyre or Tale of Two Cities or Bleak House or Pride and Prejudice, if nobody ever read them ever again, would society stop? No. But I have to believe that we wouldn't be as happy. And we wouldn't find ways to be better as easily if we didn't have these fantastic works of classic literature for us to draw on and to learn from and to just flat out enjoy. And I know that Age of Innocence, the numbers on the podcast have been going up and down pretty dramatically, which means some people are checking in and some people are checking out, and some people are waiting until the book is completely done to download the whole thing and listen to it then, which is fine. But I only see these kinds of radical variations in downloads on books that tend to be slow. Connecticut Yankee, Age of Innocence, even Persuasion had some really interesting ups and downs as we went through the book. So I don't know. I don't know. But I love this book, and I really love Brenda's reading of it, and I hope you are enjoying it as well. And on that note, I am going to go because I am busy, busy, busy. You have a great week. I will talk to you soon. Take care of yourselves. Stay warm. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Like Craftlit? Leave us a review on iTunes, like us on Facebook, or post a link to us when you comment on literary blogs. You can listen via Stitcher Radio, craftlit.com, just-the-books.com, or via our Android, our new Windows 8, or iPhone app. You can also use the free Craftlit app to access premium subscriber content. Just the Books and Craftlit are made possible by the support of our listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.